Did you know that there are over 3.2 million podcasts in the world? It seems like everybody these days has a podcast. But did you also know that 90% of those podcasts fail to make it to 20 episodes? There are various reasons for these failures, but one reason is that people don't know what they're doing. Shocking, right? As it turns out, the same reason why people don't operate on themselves also applies to podcast success. You want to talk to someone who has had success launching and marketing podcasts. Somebody like Juliana Barbati. Juliana runs a podcast marketing and production agency, and their team takes care of everything for you, making this process a breeze. All their info is in the show notes. You can go to julianabarbati.com, tell them TGFB sent you, and get a discount when paying in Bitcoin. That's right. Juliana is a Bitcoiner. Her and her husband were actually Bitcoiners before they were Christians. And so it's been great for us to work with them. They basically came to us and said, hey, we'd love to help you guys, help TGFB grow. And so we'd love to kind of apply our services to you guys. So go ahead and support them. If you have a podcast you're working on or one that you'd like to start, go ahead and check them out. Now let's get to today's show. Samuel Kuhlman, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
It's great to be here.
We've had some troubles in trying to make it to this point, but we overcame and we're here. All right, Samuel, why don't you introduce yourself for those who maybe aren't familiar with who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm 37 years old. I live in Thun, which is a small town in Switzerland, but I actually didn't grow up in Switzerland. I was born in Leeds in the United Kingdom. And a few years afterwards, my parents moved to Mongolia, where we were missionaries for 12 years. So between 1991 and 2003, we were living in Ulaanbaatar, in the capital city of Mongolia, and my parents were doing mission work there. And that's also how I got to know the Lord Jesus Christ as a child. Through the example of my parents, I gave my life to Jesus when I was 12 years old, and I got baptized when I was 15. And now I've been living in Switzerland for a bit more than 20 years.
Wow. I did not know we were going to go this way. So that's incredible. So obviously I was a missionary in Uruguay and South America just shy of 7 years and then like raised support for 3 years before that. So then I have two kids who were born in Uruguay and so
amazing.
Anytime I find missionary kids, I just have a soft spot and a particularly meaningful part of my heart that just is grateful for and knows what they go through. So. Well, that's super interesting. What do you mind me asking what your parents were doing? What kind of missionary work they were doing?
So they were with an organization called Worldwide Evangelization for Christ, WEC International, and they did different stuff. They did church planting. They were leading an NGO. My mom taught Bible school students to do like some practical works, like creating souvenirs to help pay for their school fees. But mostly my mom also wrote like the mostly used Mongolian grammar book nowadays, because when we went to Mongolia, it was just after the fall of the Iron Curtain, of the breakdown of the Soviet Empire. And so Mongolia just only opened up for non-Russian foreigners. And so there was very little language material around. And my mom, although she isn't a linguist, she's a primary school teacher, but she liked doing linguistics. So she spent like 6 years doing research and writing this grammar book, which then many other missionaries and foreigners used to learn Mongolian.
Wow, man. Praise the Lord. That's incredible. So then you moved back to where you said you moved back to Sweden after that?
Switzerland.
Switzerland, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah, you're forgiven now.
Move back to Switzerland after that.
Many Americans mix it up.
Correct. Well, and then further complicating is I have a good friend who lived in Sweden, moved to Sweden for a time, so they're too darn close. And then especially in Spanish, they're very similar, and so the names can perpetually confuse me. So, all right, so you moved back to Switzerland after being there, and so how did you adapt to life back, in a different country than where you had lived and grown up? And
yeah, so I was on furlough maybe 3 times during these 12 years, so I knew Switzerland a little bit, but it was like a holiday country. You go to and a little bit, but not really the culture. So of course, yeah, I usually say for missionary kids to go back to the countries of origin or to the parents' country, actually, it's like either it's difficult, very difficult, or extremely difficult.
Man, that sounds about right.
Yeah. I say for me, it was difficult. So I didn't feel it was as difficult as other missionary kids experienced it. Because when I was 14 or 15 years old, still living in Mongolia, out of nowhere, I got this tremendous interest for politics. And then I was like, hey, I can go to Switzerland. I knew that this was like my way. I knew my for my education that this is the logical next step. So I knew already a couple years before we came to Switzerland that this would just be the next step and that it will be hard, but that this just the way life is. And mostly I had also other missionary kids, friends, and I knew they'll be all over the world anyway. So I knew I cannot keep this, what I had in my childhood anyway, and that things will change. And so I was like accepting of these changes, knowing that it will be tough and challenging. But I also had like a vision for myself. And I knew, okay, once I'm in Switzerland, I can also get politically active. So I was looking forward to that. And I think this is what really helped me to make it a bit easier than many other MKs experience it.
Sure. So where did that come from? Where did that desire to be involved in politics? Like, I wouldn't say that's like necessarily a normal thing or a common thing for kids to grow up and, you know, and aspire to be a politician.
No, I think it's a calling I received from God, which is very strong in my life. So this is the only way I can explain it. Yeah.
Okay. And like totally accept that. But like, was there like certain circumstances that like led you to kind of see that and then think, you know, I would love to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. There were like in Switzerland, we have direct democracy, like some states in the US have as well, where you can vote on certain propositions. So in Switzerland, we vote 4 times a year on different policy issues. And in June 2002, the issue of abortion was up for vote, whether to legalize abortion. So it's not like in the US where the Supreme Court made this decision in, I think, Roe versus Wade in 1973. But in Switzerland, actually, the parliament decided to make it legal. But then a Christian party made collected signatures for a referendum vote to bring it before the public. Unfortunately, the people approved the law, but at least the people were able to vote on it. So when it was up for vote, I followed that already quite a lot. I was 14 years old at that time. And so this was one of my touching points to politics and also what it means to be as a Christian in politics.
Wow. So you said that was 14. So how long was it? I mean, when you graduate high school, you know, or the equivalent, the Swiss equivalent, is there a path that's pretty standard to go right into politics? Or is there kind of a winding road that kind of led to that, even if you knew that's what you wanted to do?
So we came back to Switzerland in June 2023. And in the same month, I went to the office of a Christian political party. I said, I'm interested to be active. And 3 weeks after arriving in Switzerland, I became a party member, being 16 years old, which was like the youngest possible. And then I also got involved in the board of the local political party and became a board member there. And so things started to take its course.
Okay. You came back in 2023?
No, sorry, 2003. Sorry for that confusion. 2003.
So 2003, you're 16 and you start getting involved in politics. So you're the youngest politician ever at that point?
I mean, I was elected into the cantonal, the state parliament when I was 30. And being 30 years old, I wasn't the youngest. And there were other people my age, 16 years old, who were involved. It wasn't common, but there were others.
Yeah. Okay. There were others. Yeah. Okay. And so what was that like? You know, 16 years old, you're kind of in the belly of the beast. You're starting to see how politics happens. And I mean, what were your takeaways? Was it what you thought it was going to be? Or
I didn't have much expectation because I didn't really know what to expect. I only got to know Switzerland as a country and Swiss politics after coming back. So, I mean, I followed through the internet. We had 1 kilobyte per second download speed in Mongolia at that time. But I had some internet, so I was able to follow a little bit of what was going on, but I didn't really know much. So I just got to know things, learning by doing.
And so what were some of your biggest takeaways from being involved in that process, especially as somebody who's younger?
I mean, I was very young also in my political party. I was always the youngest in whatever board I was in by far. So, but I mean, because it was like that from the beginning, I was sort of used to it to be like the young guy, but people respected me at least most. And they also appreciated me because at that time, my political party was a bit more elderly and was a bit, they lacked a bit young people at that time. So it's getting better now. So they were also very, very glad to have young, like someone young like me who was really active and doing things. Yeah.
So how long did you serve? I mean, at that point, you've served continuously since then.
Mostly. So I had like 1 year. I sort of withdrew a bit from politics in 2011, around there, because I was in a relationship then. So I reduced my, or maybe for 2 years, I was a bit less active. And then in 2015, I had a bit of a conflict with the leadership of my political party. And I again withdrew for 1 year. Due to some of this, some things we saw differently. But then I was quite surprisingly elected to the cantonal parliament in 2017. And so this gave me the boost to say, okay, I'm back in the ring now.
Can you explain to us, a bunch of unwashed Americans, what the cantonal parliament is and what did your role look like?
Sure. So the United States has 50 states and Switzerland has 26 states. So it's like being in the state legislature, the state parliament. So which state are you from, Jordan?
Florida.
Florida. Okay. Yeah. So you also have a state parliament and I don't know how many members are there in the state parliament.
I honestly do not know.
So there are 160 members of parliament in the parliament of Canton Bern. Canton Bern is the second largest state in Switzerland, has about 1.1 million inhabitants. And the role of parliament is, or member of parliament, is to make laws, to sort of control what the government is doing, to make the annual budget, and to elect the judges. So those are the main roles of a member of parliament, which is probably quite universal.
Sure. So you were a 16-year-old voting on these kind of issues, and or was that a little bit different?
No. That was when I was 30 years old. I got elected into the 30 parliament.
30 years old.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in Switzerland, when you're 18 years old, you can decide through direct democracy, you can decide on different policy issues and changing the constitution or repealing some law parliament has passed. But then you're just one voice out of many.
Sure, of course. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, at what point in this process did you, you know, discover Bitcoin and kind of what was your draw towards it?
So I was actually working for my party in 2015. And at that point, the Swiss National Bank pegged our currency, the Swiss franc, to the euro. And it was a peg that was last for a few years. But then the European Central Bank started to buy, like from Greece and other countries, state debt for like 60 billion euros a month. And then the Swiss National Bank said, we cannot hold this peg. Otherwise, we would have to do this insane policy. So they let the free market loose, let's say, on the Swiss franc euro pair. And then there was like a huge, I mean, the Swiss franc was, because it's like the best fiat currency there is with the lowest money supply growth. So actually it appreciated quite a lot towards the euro, about 30% within a few hours. So it was like a huge, huge market reaction. And it was on me to like release a public statement for our political party, what we think of the move by the Swiss Central Bank. And I realized I have no clue whatsoever what I'm supposed to write here. But then while I was doing the research, I realized, okay, the European Central Bank is starting to buy nation state debt. And I thought, well, this doesn't sound like it's should be like this. So there must be something wrong in the financial system. And then I intensely dug into, I mean, I tried in 2008 during the great financial crisis, I tried to read about what was going on. But then after 30 minutes, it was too complicated for me, or I lacked the interest to really follow it up. But in 2015, it really made click for me. And I realized, okay, this is something really important that is happening now. I was never interested in money before that. I never had problems with money, but yeah, just didn't care. But then suddenly I got this interest. It's like from like 0 to 100 almost. And then I very quickly also discovered the importance of silver and of gold to sort of market, position oneself more independently of the traditional financial system and of the big banks, which we, of course, also have many in Switzerland, and they've been doing lots of bad stuff also, and they also needed rescuing from the state in 2008, and now the second largest bank of Switzerland went under actually last year, while also some of the American banks got into trouble. So, yeah, but in 2015, I quickly came to gold and silver as sort of one of the ways to sort of make yourself more independent of the legacy financial system. And I know that in 2015, I must have already read about Bitcoin because of the kind of websites I was starting to read at that time. And so it kept on coming up, but I thought gold and silver is the solution. And I didn't dive deeply enough into Bitcoin to realize its potential. So I was a soccer referee at that time. And I had a colleague who told me again and again, like he said, Samuel, look at Bitcoin. And he kept on sending me links. But then it was like, oh, it was complicated. It was at the time of the fork wars and with SegWit. And I was like, what is this? I don't understand this. So, but he kept on saying, Samuel, take a look at Bitcoin. It has this huge potential. And so I said, okay, let me buy one Bitcoin. So I bought like one Bitcoin for about $900 at that time. And then it went up. Then it went up 50 or 100% within 1 month. And then I said, okay, let me take some profit. And I sold 0.9 Bitcoin. And then the bull run really started, right? So I was like, okay, well, I guess I missed that train. But I kept on looking at Bitcoin, even writing about it. I think 2018, I wrote about it in my party's newspaper. But I had my 0.1 Bitcoin at that time, so I wasn't really involved. But I knew, okay, at some point I need to do some more research. And in 2019, I started to get a bit more into it. And in 2020, I read the Bitcoin Standard, and that was my first gradually then suddenly moment. And since then, I've been like a very convinced Bitcoiner. And in 2021, I started to go to the Bitcoin meetups and to the Bitcoin conferences. And I started to become very public with my pro-Bitcoin position also as a politician, which was, like, I think I was the first in Switzerland or almost probably in Europe, or maybe almost in Europe, who was like pro-Bitcoin publicly. And I founded this group, the parliamentary group Bitcoin. And we are now a bit more than 20 MPs out of 160 who have Bitcoin, who are pro-Bitcoin, or who say, well, we're in this group to learn about Bitcoin. So, yeah, that's sort of how, yeah.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. Yeah, no, so again, for those maybe who don't know the Swiss history, I believe Switzerland was the last fiat currency to depeg from gold. Is that correct?
Yes.
Pretty sure, was it 1997, I think, that they...
I would have to check on the exact year, but in the 1990s, we still had a partial peg to gold. But then I think it was at the beginning of the 1990s when we joined the International Monetary Fund. And then actually the US government exerted pressure on the Swiss government to sell about half of their gold reserves, like at a really, really stupid moment, like the lowest price in the past 40 years. So the Swiss government decided to sell. We still have some nice gold reserves, but it was like, it's looking back, it's sad.
Yeah, that's that old phrase, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Like, you know, Switzerland was the one-eyed man in terms of sound currency for a long time. The other thing that I don't know if you know about this, but we actually have a connection. Uruguay and Switzerland collaborated to form the first, they actually tested the first digital currency. It was the e-peso, and I can't remember what year it was. I'll have to look this up later. But they collaborated. There was like a small group. They did like a small trial in both those countries. And so I just remember when I got into Bitcoin, probably within a year, I was just doing some research and somebody was like, hey, you know, we did this e-peso project here a few years ago. I was like, really?
So that was pre-Bitcoin?
Pre-Bitcoin. I believe so. I believe it was pre-Bitcoin.
Okay, interesting.
Don't quote me on
that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, in Uruguay, they used it for a little bit. Like you could use it to buy stuff. And again, it was very limited. Hardly anybody was using it, but they did it as a trial thing. So this is not the first Swiss, I'm not Uruguayan, but I consider myself an adopted son.
Uruguayan and by heart.
By heart. I'm sitting here, I'm wearing my, I'm a Liverpool football fan by virtue of The fact that Luis Suarez played for them, and then now they have Darwin Núñez.
Ah, Suarez. Okay. Plays for them.
So I'm sitting here wearing a pair of Darwin Núñez shorts as we speak right now. The TGFB podcast is brought to you by the TGFB 24 conference. Thank God for Bitcoin 2024 is happening July 24th and 25th in Nashville. This conference brings together some of the best minds in the church, the academy, and in Bitcoin to explore the biblical foundations and daily consequences of how money affects the incentives and outcomes of the world we live in. The name of the conference this year is Render to God, Stewardship, Dominion, and the Economics of Glory. We figured that an election year was the perfect time to examine the relationship between God, government, and money. We'll dive deep into what the Bible has to say about what money is, the role it plays in society, and why the principles governing money creation have such a huge and yet underappreciated effect on every aspect of our world. I'll be speaking alongside pastors and respected Christian figures like C.R. Wiley, Thomas Terry, Eric Hirschman, Glenn Sunshine, and many more. Tickets are limited, so use promo code TGFB24 to save 10% today before prices increase. You can also, for a limited time, if you would like to bring your wife with you, we would love for you to do that. We would love husbands to be able to bring their wives, and so we are offering 80% off tickets for wives who want to accompany their husbands. So that means you can get two tickets today for $300 by using promo code COUPLE at checkout at tgfb.com/store. Go ahead, run over and do that. We'd love to have husbands and wives together to talk about these very important topics. This is a one-of-a-kind community experience at the intersection of theology, technology, ethics, finance, and economics. We hope to see you there. Okay, back to the show. So you start getting into Bitcoin, you go down the rabbit hole, you learn, how did it go over, I'm imagining like a lead balloon, to the rest of your colleagues when you start talking about Bitcoin?
Some were open quite from the start, because up till then, I actually, being a member of parliament is a part-time job in Switzerland. So I also work for my political party. I'm a political scientist, but I also have my small own business, and I did like financial education since 2015. I was educating people about gold and silver and how they should go about it if they want to buy some gold and silver, and answering practical questions and educating them about like why it makes sense, about the importance of sound money, about the problems within the fiat system. So I did that for a couple of years already before Bitcoin, and I helped quite a lot of people also to get into gold and silver at actually quite good prices. So I had some clients who were already really thankful to me for advising them regarding sound money. And so when I started to, I mean, it was very slowly, I started to talk a bit more about Bitcoin in my newsletters. And so I guess some people were just a bit were also open for it because they trusted me. And so they thought, okay, if he's open for Bitcoin, then maybe there's something to it. And so it just takes a bit of time. So of course, at the beginning, more people were skeptical. Now within my political party, we're about to like be one of the first parties in Switzerland to accept Bitcoin donations. And we're just about to implement that. And that is also, of course, to my advocacy for Bitcoin. So there have been really a lot of people now also in my party, because we were in the COVID times, we were like the only political party in Switzerland, and there are about 12 parties in parliament. And we were the only one like in the national parliament, and we were the only one that said no to the COVID-19 law when we first voted on it. And we were almost unanimously against like the almost forced vaccinations and all those crazy COVID measures. So my party took a really firm position on these issues. And people realize that if you're on the wrong side of the state, it can be quite uncomfortable. And so I think that helped a lot of people to realize, okay, what if the financial system is being weaponized against me? And knowing, okay, maybe it's good to have alternatives. So, but because we are a Christian party, we're a conservative political party, so there's this skepticism towards everything digital, which is one of the biggest, so this is number one, this skepticism towards digital things that people need to overcome. And Hal Finney wrote, said this beautiful thing, the computer can be used as a tool for liberation and not for oppression. So this is what I'm trying to communicate to people. And I'm also saying, look, CBDCs are coming. So basically, we live in the digital age. So it will be either CBDCs or Bitcoin. So choose your fighter. And through this kind of argumentation, I think many Christians are also like recognizing the value and the importance of Bitcoin. But that's the like struggle number one, the skepticism towards digital things. The second part is maybe even more difficult. It's like maybe Bitcoin's almost too good to be true. Isn't like with the Antichrist and the eschatology and the number of the beast, and isn't Bitcoin like, there are Christians who are saying, well, Samuel is advocating Bitcoin and driving Christians into the hands of the Antichrist. And so I need to sort of, I'm not many people are saying this, but there are some. And so I need to deal with this kind of criticism. And then I just try to say, okay, look, we have like one or two verses in the Bible. We don't know the time frame. We don't know the exact interpretation. Maybe this was already in the past, or this is cyclical again and again. Maybe it won't be like totally global. And I'm like, I'm not basing my today's financial decisions on one very specific interpretation of one verse in the Bible. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those things that always baffles me. Because again, you can imagine, as a Christian, I do this for a living, you know, talking about Bitcoin. So I run into these same things. And I'm just like, I just don't understand. Again, it superficially makes sense. But the moment you start, like, if you take it seriously, you start thinking, all right, like the idea of governments like forcing people to use Bitcoin is hilarious. Like, governments, when you actually understand the incentives of government, like, they don't want to have people use something that they don't control. Like, they would never let people, I mean, basically, if you presented them the opportunity of, you can have a scarce bearer asset, something like cash, or something, a digital CBDC where they control everything, just how long it lasts, all that kind of stuff. They're going to choose that 100 times out of 100. And so
maybe
I just think
not.
Bitcoin is very, yeah.
But I agree. I mean, Bitcoin doesn't have these characteristics that a totalitarian state would look for.
Correct. Yeah. And so that seems to be, you know, what's being described there is like this thing where they can control every single aspect of it. You know, like, you, unless you have this, you can't buy or sell. And so again, it's like this top-down control. The other thing that I, when I talk to people, you know, that's humorous to me, is that gold is closer to a one world currency than any other currency will ever be, basically. I mean, again, the dollar is still, you know, is pretty widely used. And I mean, again, you can get it in every country. So you could argue, you know, the dollar's closer to being, you know, the currency described there.
I mean, you even have the pyramid and the all-seeing eye on the dollar bill. So
exactly.
I mean, people say Bitcoin is a pyramid scheme, but it's literally there on the U.S. dollar bill.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Get the log out of your own eye. You know, that's what we should be saying. You know, get the log out of your own eye before you look at Bitcoin. But yeah, so, I mean, let's talk about that, if you don't mind. Like, has that, like, discussions around, you know, around a CBDC, is that something that you've been involved in those discussions, or is that, you know, at an EU level and you're not really involved in that? Or
We are involved. So the Swiss Central Bank has tested CBDC, started to test one in last December, but it's a wholesale CBDC, so not retail. So it's just between banks, because they are probably aware that Swiss citizens are a bit more critical in their thinking and might not approve like this, the kind of CBDC where you have no privacy anymore, and they are aware, well, at the end there can be a referendum and people can vote against this if so they probably not know that they have certain political limits that they need to respect, at least at this point. Who knows what will be in 5 or 10 years, but on the European level, they are much more aggressively going to, I'm not sure if I got the terminology right. Is the wholesale CBDC the one for the general population?
I'm not positive.
Let me quickly just to make sure that we're, no, I got it right. So here, a retail CBDC is a form of central bank digital currency that is used by the general public, and the wholesale CBDC is amongst banks and other licensed financial institutions. So I got it right in the first, but just wanted to make sure. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So they're working on that. And so you guys are involved in those discussions. You're basically thinking these things through at a local level, at a Swiss level.
Yeah. I mean, the parliament is not really discussing this at the moment, because it's like a test phase, and it's most people in parliament, they don't have that kind of financial literacy to understand actually the fiat financial system, how the banking system works. So I think right now it's almost a non-issue. But because they're also not going full retail CBDC, I think it's also something that's not too alarming yet. So, I mean, if it's between the central bank and the banks, it's like, yeah, whatever, let them do what they want to do. So I don't care too much about that.
Yeah. You guys are in a better position. I feel like if there's, I mean, just the legacy of gold, obviously we know it was there at some point, you know, if it was in the 90s, like that's more recently than, you know, pretty much anybody else. But like, what would you say the average like financial literacy is among the average person in Switzerland? Is it, do you think it'd be higher than average? Or
it's definitely higher than average because of the opportunities of direct democracy. We had actually a popular initiative. So if you are a group of citizens and you say, we want to change or amend the Swiss constitution, then you can gather 100,000 ballot signatures. And then all Swiss citizens have the opportunity to vote on your proposed amendment. So in 2014, we voted on backing the Swiss franc again by 20% with gold. So there was this gold initiative that we voted on, and I believe about 30% said yes. So at least 30% at that time had a kind of understanding of sound money. But I mean, the parliament was overwhelmingly against it. I mean, if the people say yes, then it's a yes, but still the parties, they influence their electorate and they make recommendations, say, nah, don't vote for this. This doesn't fit into our system now and it's old and outdated. So even myself, that was like a few months before I started to go down the rabbit hole, I even voted no because I didn't have enough understanding of the matter at that time. And in 2018, we had another initiative we voted on, which was for full reserve banking. So sort of abolishing fractional reserve banking, which would have also been a good step. And there about 23% said yes. And there were like no parties really backing it. So, but at least 23% had enough understanding to vote yes. So, and then whenever there are these kinds of votes taking place, we have public discussions. All the political parties on the national, the regional, the local level, they have their congregations and they discuss the pro and contra arguments for those things. So, and then on TV, there are debates on these matters. So because we were able to have this political debate through our direct democratic rights, I believe we are further along with educating the people about how the financial system works, importance of sound money, and so on.
And so I would imagine that had something to do with you deciding to write a book.
Yes. Actually, my writing a book, and I published it in just last month in April. It's like I tried to write the kind of book I wish I could have given myself 10 years ago. Because I did a lot of mistakes. I also had my shitcoin phase. I had my trading phase when I was following a crypto guru who always knew what the market will do, but then somehow it never worked for me. Oh, really?
Yeah. He's counter trading and dumping on you. Yeah.
I don't know if he did it if it was his purpose or if I just didn't have the skills. So I'll leave that open. Anyway, I just wanted to write a book explaining Bitcoin, its essential concepts to people who have not really studied Bitcoin before. It's quite a short book. Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Bitcoin is Freedom, the most important things explained in a simple way. I mean, it's in German so far. Maybe I'll do an English translation at some point. But actually, the idea to write the book, I never planned on writing books at this stage in my life. I thought maybe in a few decades, I'll write a book about my life or so. But last year, I got into contact with an elderly Jewish, a Messianic Jewish lady, and she asked me whether I would like her to be my mentor, or like I have another mentor, but she would have a bit more time also. And so I said yes. And she's also strong in the prophetic gift. And she told me, Samuel, you need to work on your political profile and you need to start writing books. Not just one book, but books. And I said, well, okay, I wasn't planning on that, but let's think about it, pray about it. And then I thought to myself, well, what could I write about? Then it became quite clear, well, I'm doing these webinars once a month, free webinars, just explaining Bitcoin to people who have not really heard about it before or just who want to inform themselves. And I thought, well, I can write a book about Bitcoin since I'm doing like a lot of research on Bitcoin anyway and writing on X and Facebook and explaining it to people all the time anyway. So why not write a book? And once I started writing in January, it all went very quick and I realized it was really the right thing to do. And I was very glad for this prophetic impulse.
Sure. So what has been kind of the response? I mean, it's only been out for probably a few weeks at this point, maybe a month, but like what's been the response so far? Has it been kind of what you thought it was going to be, or has it been more muted or maybe more excited? What's been the response?
I had only good feedback so far on the contents of the book. I didn't really have the big time to do like a lot of advertising yet, and I published it with my mentor. She has like an own small publishing house. And so we were able to do it really quickly, but it's not like a big publishing house or so at this moment. So we sold about 200 books so far, printing some more as we're speaking. So I'm quite happy. It's a small start, but people are really appreciating the book. At least those I have feedback from, they really, really like it. And so I'm glad about that. Yeah.
Are most of the sales there in, you know, from people, I would imagine, in Switzerland? But if, and the fact that it's written in German, I would imagine, you know, there's some German.
Yeah, we also have sales in Germany. Yeah.
In Germany. Okay, cool. Well, okay. So I guess when you think about the central bank digital currency stuff, what does the timeline look like in Europe, you know, in your opinion? Like, is it something where this is definitely going to happen and it's going to happen soon? Or is this something where it's still kind of in play? You know, you're dealing with something that's still pretty complicated, even for, you know, I mean, just this is where some of the dynamics of, you know, older people being the primary political drivers of some of these things actually works in our favor. You know, it can be too complicated for them to really understand. You know, kind of what is your perspective on that? Where do you think we're at?
I think politically they are pressing ahead in the European Union. So I think they try to implement it within the next two or three years, as far as I know. But I mean, it could very well be that they run into technical difficulties or that at the end, once they are really getting concrete to roll it out, that maybe commercial banks will be opposing it because they say, well, it's affecting us negatively. Or maybe that they're not even competent enough to do this in within 2 or 3 years. I mean, there are people who say, well, what if Bitcoin was developed by the NSA or some other three-letter agency, but there's so many good reasons why this is hardly the case. One of the reasons is because governments usually are not competent enough to do this kind of genius stuff. what Bitcoin is. So let's see if they are just technically able to pull it off in a way that also makes sense, at least that is somewhat practical for them. And with the European Union and the euro, you also don't really know, like if we go into a financial crisis within the next 1 or 2 years, which could very well happen, it's not clear whether the euro will survive another crisis. So I think things are open. It's great to have Bitcoin as an alternative at this stage. I think Bitcoin came too early for the powers to be. They're behind, actually, with the control of the CBDC project. And so far, I think it's looking quite good that Bitcoin will have a decisive advantage and winning actually the race.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things where, again, we get so, I feel like, gaslit into just losing and just get so used to, you know, government getting bigger and them just doing more and more just overtly awful things and short-sighted things and, you know, self-interested things that we just get used to
losing.
Get used to losing. Yeah. And I think it's one of these things where, again, one of the ways that we talk about on this podcast all the time is just Bitcoin through the lens of sowing and reaping. And, you know, you look at this, like, again, this is the nature of sowing and reaping, is that if you sow to the flesh, like if you make short-sighted decisions, you're going to eventually reap the consequences of those. It might look stable for a while and quicker than you're thinking. It's going to obviously appear to be foolish. And so I think this is one of these things where you're devaluing your own currency. You know, there's been a race to devalue by every country on earth. And so, you know, they're all just purposely weakening themselves to try to survive. And then, you know, in that environment, you have this little magic internet money, guys playing around on the internet. Anybody could have mined it, you know, for all this time. And that is quickly becoming the dominant form of money in the world, adopted by people from pretty much every country on earth. And it's just demonstrating how foolish and weak all these countries are. I quote Psalm 2 all the time. I feel like Bitcoin is Psalm 2 money, you know, where basically all these nations, they say like they want to rebel.
Yeah, they rage. They rage against Bitcoin.
They rage. They absolutely rage. And they want to throw off these limitations put on them by reality, put on them by the world. And then Bitcoin shows up and it's just like, nope. Here's reality in digital form. You can't change it. You can't mess with it. And it makes them angry. So
kiss me, embrace me, unless you'll be punished.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing is, again, yeah, I just think that's the reality is like Jesus is the king of the world and you can't escape it. And so again, it might look all shiny and might seem different, but again, he's still in control and he's going to exert that control, you know, at different points. So I guess, let me ask you this, like in terms of Mongolia, have you been back to Mongolia since you were returned to Switzerland?
Yeah, we were back as a family for 2 weeks in 2005. So 2 years after we left. So a lot was still the same at that point, but already many, many of my friends were already gone. So it was like coming back. So I was still not really feeling at home in Switzerland at that point. But then I went back to Mongolia and realized it's also not home anymore. It's like it's not the same anymore. So I realized, okay, yeah, it just helped me to really settle in Switzerland, definitely, these 2 weeks in Mongolia. And then I went back in 2015 for 2 weeks and I hope to perhaps go there next year again now.
Okay. Were the people who you're friends with, were they from Switzerland or were they from the States or where were they from? Yeah.
Many from the States, many South Koreans, some British, some German. But many from the States. So greetings go out to Mike Springer. Should you at any point listen to this podcast? He used to be my principal at the homeschool co-op we used to have. He's from Colorado and he was a fantastic principal. I learned a lot from him. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Mike, we'd love to have you. We haven't even talked about this, but I don't know what you're doing in July, but we'd love to have you at TGFB 24 in Nashville. I'm sure you're busy with lots of stuff. You know, you got work and all kinds of stuff.
Not in the summer, actually. So I can really think about it. Yeah.
Man, we might need to get you on a panel as well, because that's the whole conference this year is about the intersection of government, God, and money. So we're going to be talking about these things.
I'll look into the dates. I'll see if I can make it happen. Would be very interesting for me. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we'd love to have you. I'll give you the last word here. Like, is there, you know, anything else that you think would be, I mean, either to talk about, I mean, we still have plenty of time, but just anything that you want to just kind of leave with our audience or questions or anything along those lines?
Yeah. There's something that I realized a bit deeper within the past few months, also while writing the book. And I think it might be something that helps people who are maybe a bit new to Bitcoin. And it's about the issue of volatility. So volatility is a big challenge for those who are new to Bitcoin or who don't have that very firm conviction yet. But in the past few months, I really realized that volatility was our greatest protection because it kept the big players off for 15 years. So it gave the small guy a 15-year head start, which is amazing. You don't have that with any other financial product. It's first Wall Street takes their cut and then the small guys have their opportunity. But with Bitcoin, it's the other way around. And it was volatility that made this happen. So volatility guarantees that the right kind of people own Bitcoin, or mostly those who have the deep conviction. So I just think it's a helpful way to look at the challenge of price volatility, especially if you're new to Bitcoin. Realize it's your protection. If you put in the proof of work, if you put in the research, if you put in the hours, this can bring you way, way ahead of almost everyone else and the big governments and the pension funds and China and Putin and the oil shakes. This is what brings you ahead of them. And so embrace it. And yeah,
I know. I love that. I love that. I think again, like there's, I can't remember. I don't remember if this is, if we came up with this or, but just like volatility is the price of life. There's dead things. Dead things are perfectly stable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so many parallels between Bitcoin and Christianity or spirituality. I mean, also the Christian faith is like there's persecution in different kinds of forms, and it just, it has to be. There's no Christian life without some form of persecution. This is what tests your faith, what makes your faith stronger. And so it is the same with Bitcoin.
Yep. Yeah. Every 4 years on average, it gets, you know, everybody thinks Bitcoin dies and then it resurrects. So there's definitely tons of parallels there. But well, cool. Well, Samuel, thank you so much for your time. And again, hopefully this won't be the last time. We'll have you on again. Hopefully it will be because Switzerland makes Bitcoin legal tender here in the next couple of years, and then that'd be fantastic.
We actually are in the preparation stage for launching a popular initiative to one of articles in our constitution that says, where it says the Swiss Central Bank holds reserves in gold, and we want to add the two words and Bitcoin. So I'm actually part of the project group that is about to start that, and it was also in the media in the past few days. So we're hoping I hope Switzerland will be one of the first movers.
This would probably be, you know, sacrilegious or, you know, frowned upon. But hey, let us know if there's anything us Americans can do to help. You know, we've probably, you know, we're unwantingly exerting all kinds of influence. But if we, you know, over the world. But if there's anything we can do to, you know, to kind of get the word out.
Well, America also had a tremendous amount of positive influence. So it's like, it's really both. I mean, a lot of really bad stuff, but also a lot of really, really good stuff. Tons of missionaries. And like, so it's definitely balancing itself out. And we appreciate all the positive help we can get.
Amen. Well, we'll leave it on that note. Positive things about America. This is not something you get very much, but you can come to expect that here on Thank God for Bitcoin. Samuel, thank you for your time, brother, and we'll talk to you soon.
You're so welcome. It was a pleasure. God bless.
Our mission at TGFB is to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. We do this through podcasts, books, consulting services, and live events. We love giving away as much of our resources as possible, but we do have real overhead costs. And there are a number of easy ways that you can help us keep the lights on to continue our mission. First, if you're a Bitcoiner, you can listen to the podcast on the Fountain app and stream us sats in real time as you listen to the podcast. Every contribution makes a difference, no matter how small. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/TGFB to receive a number of special benefits available only to our Patreon supporters. If you find these conversations valuable, you can also help spread the word by sharing this episode, subscribing on YouTube, and leaving reviews on Apple and Spotify. Leaving us good reviews goes a long way toward ensuring that the algorithmic powers that be look favorably on our humble endeavors. And finally, engage with us on social media. Join the conversation so that we can build a strong community united around faith, freedom, and sound money. We mentioned the TGFB 24 conference on July 24th and 25th in Nashville. You can go grab your tickets at tgfb.com/store. And finally, go check out julianabarbati.com if you have questions about how to start or better your own podcast. We're grateful for your support, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.